This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Netanyahu warns of a prolonged campaign in Gaza. Our correspondent describes the feelings there as he stands before a demolished mosque.
A mixture of fear, nervousness, anger, despair.
A top U.S. diplomat says U.S.-India ties are at a potentially transformative moment. The Philippine president is facing impeachment complaints. And looking back at World War I 100 years later, it's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Attacks from Israeli warplanes and tanks have killed at least 26 people in the Gaza Strip as the military pressed on with the campaign that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned could continue for a long time. Palestinian health officials said their overall death toll stood at more than 1,100 today, mainly civilians, after the most widespread night of airstrikes by Israeli forces since the fighting began 3 weeks ago. One airstrike today hit fuel tanks at Gaza's only plant, causing it to shut down. Before the strike, damage to the system had limited electricity to only 3 hours a day. Mr. Netanyahu told Israelis in a televised address Monday to prepare for a prolonged campaign against Hamas. He said the military's operation will not end without Israeli forces dismantling a network of tunnels Hamas militants used to sneak into Israel. VOA correspondent Scott Bobb is in Gaza.
Well, Gaza is relatively calm Monday during the day after a very violent night. Residents say it was one of the worst of the three-week-old conflict here. I'm standing in front of one of Gaza City's principal mosques, the Amin Mohammed Mosque, that was hit by an Israeli strike over the night. The mosque is basically destroyed, gutted. There's a fire in the basement. And a house belonging to Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas across the street sustained some light damage. Israel accuses Hamas of concealing weapons and rocket launching sites in mosques and schools and other sort of civilian places, and as a result says that they are fair game. So this is evidently what happened here. Right now, young men, volunteers, are sweeping up the rubble around the mosque and in the street around it and trying to clear out what's left in the basement. But this building will clearly have to be demolished.
What is the feeling there among the people?
A mixture of fear, nervousness, anger, despair. This has been going on for 3 weeks. Everyone knows someone, if not many, people who have been killed. We just got through speaking to some people at a site yesterday where 10 children who were playing in the street were killed by a strike, a missile, a rocket of some sort. And we spoke to one of the boys, one of the dead boys' brothers who picked him up and basically watched him die. So these kind of emotional events really are very emotional for everyone. So it's hard to describe, but sometimes people are angry and sometimes they just express kind of despair.
We've seen a hospital hit. We've seen a schoolyard hit. Is there anywhere people can go where they'll feel safe?
They don't feel there's anywhere they can go. Even the UN schools that are now housing more than 100,000 displaced have been hit. So, no, I would say most Palestinians have adopted sort of a fatalistic attitude that there's nowhere they can go. They can't leave the Gaza Strip. And so they really are sort of in what they like to think of as a prison and just are sitting ducks.
So there's no way for them to get out of Gaza?
No, you have to have a special permission and a good reason to obtain to receive permission from the Israeli authorities. And, of course, right now no one is crossing. All the crossings are closed, both to Israel and to Egypt. So they basically can't go anywhere.
What about the necessities of life, food, water, that sort of thing? Or do they have medical supplies?
Hospitals say they're starting to run short of some supplies. The humanitarian workers are doing as best they can. There have been humanitarian ceasefires allowed here in the recent days to allow some resupply and allow people to go to their homes and also restock their food and basic necessities. But yes, things are starting to be in short supply. Food, I have not heard people complain too much other than it's expensive and people are afraid to spend too much money and many of the shops and grocery markets are closed. So it's just a very delicate, uncertain situation.
Well, thank you very much, Scott, and you be careful.
Thank you.
VOA correspondent Scott Bobb in Gaza. A day after returning to Washington from days of shuttle diplomacy in the Middle East, which failed to secure the week-long ceasefire he sought, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry addressed the crisis in Gaza from the State Department.
Today, we are continuing to work toward establishing an unconditional humanitarian ceasefire, one that could honor Eid, which begins now, and that will stop the fighting, allow desperately needed food and medicine and other supplies into Gaza, and enable Israel to address the threat which we fully understand and which is real, the threat posed by tunnel attacks, and to be able to do so without having to resort to combat. That is what could come from a ceasefire. We believe the momentum generated by a humanitarian ceasefire is the best way to be able to begin to negotiate and find out if you can put in place a sustainable ceasefire.
Secretary Kerry also said any long-term agreement must include taking weapons from Hamas.
We also believe that any process to resolve the crisis in Gaza in a lasting and meaningful way must lead to the disarmament of Hamas and all terrorist groups. And we will work closely with Israel and regional partners and the international community in support of this goal.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry speaking Monday here in Washington.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Just days before traveling to India for the annual strategic dialogue with India, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says relations are at a potentially transformative moment with a new Indian government that presents new opportunities. VOA's Victor Beatty reports, despite historically rocky ties, Kerry foresees a partnership that could help solve some of the world's greatest challenges.
Speaking Monday to the Center for American Progress, a liberal think tank, Kerry said the overwhelming election victory of Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party presents new possibilities to broaden U.S.-India ties.
India's new government has won an historic mandate to deliver change and reform. And together, we have a singular opportunity to help India to be able to meet that challenge, to boost two-way trade, to drive South Asia's connectivity, to develop cleaner energy, to deepen our security partnership in the Asia Pacific and beyond. The United States and India can and should be indispensable partners for the 21st century, and that is, I assure you, the way we approach the Modi government and the way we view this particular time.
The top U.S. diplomat says India's new plan, Together with All, Development for All, is a concept the United States wants to be a part of. He says the American private sector wants to be a catalyst for India's economic revitalization.
American companies lead in exactly the key sectors where India wants to grow, in high-end manufacturing, in infrastructure, in healthcare, information technology, all of them vital to sort of leapfrogging stages of development so you can provide more faster to more people.
Kerry says Washington cannot direct U.S. companies to invest in India and urged New Delhi to open its economy even more to foreign investment.
If India's government delivers on its plans to support greater space for private initiative, if it creates greater openness for capital flows, if it limits subsidies that stifle competition, if it provides strong intellectual property rights, believe me, even more American companies will come to India. They may even race to India.
Kerry says the two countries should aim to boost bilateral trade from the current $100 billion to $500 billion. He also called for an Indo-Pacific trade corridor to put, in his words, India at the heart of a more prosperous and connected Asian region. But Kerry also indirectly criticized India for its opposition to an international agreement on easing trade regulations. New Delhi says the effort to promote global trade should be linked to food security. The World Trade Organization's deadline for reaching agreement on the Bali Trade Facilitation Agreement is Thursday. RAND Corporation South Asia analyst Jonah Blank says it will take many such bilateral meetings to overcome long-standing suspicions between the two countries.
There is a legacy of distrust between the U.S. and India that has been in place for a number of years, but it's gotten a lot worse in the past about 8 or 9 months.
Blank says there is a cultural distrust that goes back to the Cold War and India's leadership role in the non-aligned movement. He says relations took a nosedive last December when India's Deputy Consul General Devyani Khobragade was arrested, strip-searched, and indicted on charges of lying about a visa application and underpaying a domestic house worker. However, Blank says Mr. Modi's parliamentary majority gives him space to strike bold deals with countries like the United States without having to worry about his coalition partners. And he says Kerry's trip shows New Delhi the respect it believes it deserves. IHS Global Insight chief economist Rajiv Biswas says the Modi government is showing its willingness to open its market to outside investors.
The Modi government's first budget did lift the caps on investment in insurance and also in defense up to 49%. It still doesn't allow majority ownership in those areas, but at least it's a step in the right direction.
Biswas says he also expects India to liberalize the process by which foreign investments are approved. He says for foreign businesses, India represents an enormous market potential, with current consumer spending of $1 trillion this year expected to explode to $4 trillion in 20 years. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
The head of the recovery mission for the Malaysian passenger jet, which was downed in eastern Ukraine recently, vowed on Monday to recover the remains of all victims of the crash once they gain access to the site. Speaking at a news conference in Kiev, Peter Jop Alsberger, a Dutch police officer, expressed disappointment in the team's inability to reach the crash site due to heavy fighting in the area.
The experts and I are deeply disappointed that we were unable to reach the crash site again. Our colleagues in Donetsk are highly driven and motivated to get to work at the site. They left the Netherlands and Australia with a great haste for this mission. It is frustrating to have to wait to do the job they came to do. Their motivation comes from the deep conviction that the relatives in all the different countries are entitled to have their loved ones and their personal effects returned to them.
The mandate of the police team is to secure the crash site area so that comprehensive investigations can begin and any remaining bodies can be recovered. 10 days after the disaster, a full-fledged investigation still has not begun at the crash site, with some bodies still unrecovered and the site forensically compromised. Concerns about the integrity of the site were raised further when the parents of a young woman who died in the disaster flew from their home in Perth, Australia, to visit the site on Saturday and even sat on part of the plane's wreckage. In New York Monday, Russia's ambassador to the United Nations, Vitaly Churkin, said Ukraine was to blame for the ongoing fighting around the crash site of the Malaysian passenger plane, which prevents the international police team from investigating the crash site.
The Ukrainian military activity in the area has exceeded all humanly imaginable limits. They are shelling with long-range artillery-populated areas. People are dying, civilians are dying by the dozen.
Churkin also spoke about what Moscow believes is the potential for lasting effects from what's happening in Ukraine.
You know, the territorial integrity of a country is not just about the territory. It's about the people. So if this is the mode of operation in which Kyiv wants to reunite the people of Ukraine, this is a tragic blunder, which may have very serious long-term consequences.
Kyiv contends Moscow is behind most of the pro-Russian separatist activity in eastern Ukraine.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
After months of speculation, China has formally announced it has opened a corruption investigation into retired senior politician Zhao Yongkang, who until 2012 was one of the country's elite leaders. The official Xinhua news agency said late today that the former security chief and member of the all-powerful Politburo Standing Committee is being probed for a suspected serious disciplinary violation. No other details of Zhao's suspected crimes were given in Xinhua's one-sentence dispatch. It is the first time in decades that China's Communist Party has investigated economic crimes by a former or current member of the Standing Committee, the country's highest governing body. Philippine President Benigno Aquino is fighting for his political career in the face of several impeachment complaints and approval ratings that have dipped to their lowest level since he took office 4 years ago. From Manila, Simon Orendine reports the controversy is over a government spending program, parts of which the High Court struck down this month.
Hundreds of protesters bearing colorful signs and banners snake their way toward the outer roads of the congressional building. They air their gripes, as they do each year before the president gives a national address at the start of the congressional session. But this year, New Patriotic Alliance Party Secretary General Renato Reyes says there is an impeachment complaint to back their displeasure.
It's really about holding the president accountable and having a platform to explain the issues to the people. So we're trying to explain to the people how funds are being used, why discretionary spending is really wrong, why the items in the DAP are not really beneficial to the people.
The Aquino administration created the DAP, or Disbursement Acceleration Program, in 2011. The idea was to fast-track public projects with money from other agencies that went unspent. But early this month, the Supreme Court ruled portions of the program unconstitutional. It said it was unconstitutional to take money out of budgets before the fiscal year ended, transfer it to branches of government beyond the office of the executive, and fund projects that were not covered by the general spending plan. Reyes and other critics call it the president's personal pork barrel fund, which is government funds that politicians use for local projects. They equate pork barrel spending with funds that are hard to account for and vulnerable to corruption. The administration's budget team, flanked by most of the president's cabinet secretaries, went before a Senate Finance Committee, which held a hearing on the DAP last week. In a mixture of Filipino and English, committee chairman Francis Escudero questioned DAP's status outside of general appropriations.
Because it's difficult on the part of Congress to be proposed projects, only to find out, although belatedly, halfway through the year.
He says it's difficult on the part of Congress to be proposed projects, only to find out belatedly, halfway through the year, they won't be implemented, and then the funds are transferred to other projects that Congress does not even know about. Budget Secretary Florencio Abad defended the program, saying it was funded through savings that resulted in cutting practices vulnerable to corruption. Abad said it brought a dramatic improvement to economic growth. During his national address Monday, Aquino cited examples of how the quick funding helped the school system and disaster response efforts, among numerous other initiatives.
Alam po pong kaisa kayong
He says, I know that those of you in this hall are one with me in believing that we must not deprive our countrymen of benefits and that these should reach them in the soonest possible time. This is why we are proposing the passage of a supplemental budget for 2014 so that the implementation of our programs and projects need not be compromised. The administration stopped the use of DAP and submitted a motion for reconsideration to the Supreme Court. Petitioners have been asked to respond. Ramon Casible heads the Philippine Institute for Political and Electoral Reform. He says the president is not vulnerable to the impeachment calls because the complainants simply do not have the votes in Congress. But Casible points out Aquino's ratings in two major surveys place him at 55% approval, significantly lower than the 60 and 70% he consistently enjoyed as recently as this year. He says Aquino is insisting on the DAP.
He wants to make the Supreme Court accept that what he did was right. And the problem, of course, is that you're talking to a referee. The Supreme Court is not the protagonist here. The irony, of course, is that Congress, which is the one handling the purse of the nation, is not complaining.
Casible says Congress partially benefited from DAP spending. He says instead of defending the program, Aquino should focus on ridding his administration of certain incompetent officials and solidifying his anti-corruption legacy in these last 2 years of his term. Simone Orendine for VOA News, Manila.
Austria and Serbia Monday observed the 100th anniversary of Austria's declaration of war, the beginning of hostilities that was to become World War I, involving battles in Africa and the Pacific and troops from all over the world. It all began on the Danube River as Austro-Hungarian gunboats and artillery shelled Serbia. In Vienna Monday, Austrian and Serb diplomats attended an exhibition of the war declaration document on display at the Leopold Museum. Speaking in Niš, Serbia Monday, Serbian Prime Minister Aleksandar Vučić lamented that Serbia lost 1.2 million people, more than a quarter of the nation's population, during the war. The declaration by Austria and Hungary came 1 month after the assassination of the Austrian Archduke Ferdinand and his wife in Sarajevo by a Serb nationalist. Retired U.S. Foreign Service officer Ambassador Leonard Shurtleff is president of the World War I Historical Association. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty, everything in the world changed with the First World War.
Nothing was the same after World War I. The map changed. Half a dozen or more new countries appeared in Europe. Ruling houses, the Romanovs in Russia, the Hohenzollerns in Germany, the Habsburgs in Austria, disappeared. People lost faith in progress and in good works. They were embittered by the war. Millions of lives were ruined. Nothing was the same. Diplomacy wasn't the same after the war. Military affairs weren't the same. Governance wasn't the same. Everything changed.
Was it a conflict that could have been avoided?
Probably. I tend to look at it. You know, everybody tries to look for who to blame. What I blame is a breakdown, an utter breakdown in the system of diplomacy that was supposed to keep Europe peaceful. Everybody spent more time trying to posture and cover themselves than they didn't try to solve the underlying problems. And they've been doing it for a decade or more the same way, except they were lucky the first few times. But once it really got serious, the whole system imploded.
What lessons are drawn from the First World War, and are we losing sight of those lessons today?
What we did learn from it was that you need a strong international organization so that people talk rather than fight. And after World War II, of course, we did what Woodrow Wilson wanted to do in 1919. We created not the League of Nations, but the United Nations. So we do that. There's also much better communications among and between the military services and the civilian part of government. This was utterly lacking in Europe in 1914. Also, people are not that quick to pull the trigger anymore. Atomic bomb had something to do with that, but we had how many years of Cold War with the Soviet Union? So, yeah, I think we've learned a bit from it.
Are there lessons that we have forgotten?
We've certainly forgotten in terms of dealing with some of the smaller countries of the world, particularly the Middle East, just how difficult it is to come up with solutions to their problems. We should learn better because the British, of course, occupied Iraq and Iran and much of Syria in World War One, and ended up with a bloody nose, the same way with Afghanistan. They fought two wars with Afghanistan. We seem to keep forgetting about these peripheral areas and how difficult they are to control.
Was there also a lesson from the Treaty of Versailles, which obviously laid the seeds, the groundwork, if you will, for the Second World War?
What rankled the Germans about Versailles was that they had to sign a treaty that accused them or said that they were responsible for starting the war. That rankled. Probably unfair. But in terms of starting World War II, Hitler came to power not because of the Versailles Treaty, because Germany had recovered economically within 4 or 5 years and had resumed its place as Europe's leading industrial power. Full unemployment, all the rest. They were doing very well until 1929, when the roof fell in on everybody, including us. And that's what triggered Hitler's rise to power.
Retired U.S. Foreign Service Officer Ambassador Leonard Shurtleff. What became known as the Great War lasted more than 50 months to November 1918 and left millions of people dead, wounded, and maimed. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On July 29, 1958, President Dwight D. Eisenhower signed into law the National Aeronautics and Space Act, establishing an agency responsible for America's space effort. NASA, as it is known, has been responsible for many achievements in space exploration, as well as numerous technological and scientific contributions. On this day in 1588, English naval forces skirmished with Spain's so-called Invincible Armada off the coast of France. Spain's King Philip II hoped the Armada would spearhead an invasion of Britain. The English, however, emerged victorious, and although the Armada's losses were not great, the ships were forced to set a course for home. On this day in 1981, millions of television viewers worldwide witnessed the marriage of the heir to the British throne, then 32-year-old Prince Charles, to the then 20-year-old English schoolteacher, Lady Diana Spencer. The couple's romance was, at that time, the envy of the world. However, the couple's marriage was anything but a fairy tale. It ended in divorce 15 years later. And on this day in 1967, the Doors emerged from their underground status to top the American pop charts with this song.
You know that it would be untrue. You know that I would be a liar if I was to say to you, girl, we couldn't get much higher. Come on, light my fire.
Light My Fire was also a major hit for Puerto Rican singer Jose Feliciano, whose version of this song helped win him the 1969 Grammy for Best New Artist. I'm Dave DeForest with Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply concerned by the convictions of human rights lawyer Tulani Maseko and magazine editor Beki Makubu for contempt of court in the Kingdom of Swaziland. Both men denied the charges, saying they were expressing opinions in the public interest and calling for the rule of law to be upheld. The men were detained in March after writing articles published in Mr. Makubu's magazine, The Nation, in which they raised concerns about judicial independence and integrity in Swaziland. Amnesty International reported that Makubu and Maseko were not arrested or tried in accordance with Swaziland's normal legal processes. Beki Makubu and Tulani Maseko have spent over 100 days in Sidwashini jail. Their convictions for contempt of court, for publishing an article critical of the High Court of Swaziland, and their ongoing detention, said U.S. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Marie Harf, appear to undermine respect for Swaziland's human rights obligations, particularly the right to freedom of expression. This right, she noted, is enshrined in Swaziland's own constitution and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. The United States strongly supports the universal fundamental freedom of expression and urges the Swazi government to uphold the rights of Chulani Maseko and Becky Makubu to speak and report freely.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.